Hi, and welcome to this audio edition of Polygamy, What Love Is This? With host Doris Hansen. On this program, we discuss polygamy and Mormon fundamentalism from a biblical Christian perspective. We talk about the history of polygamy, its modern-day fruit, share stories from people who have escaped polygamy, and talk about current events relating to polygamy. You can learn more about the video edition of this program at whatloveisthis.tv. And now, here's Doris.
What Love Is This? We are broadcast live from Salt Lake City, Utah, where the fullness of the gospel of Joseph Smith continues to be lived out daily with the local polygamy groups. This is a live telephone call-in program, and we welcome your telephone calls as we open our phone lines a little bit later in the program to ask us your questions and voice your concerns and comments on the subject of polygamy. Our telephone number is 801-973-TV20. You might want to jot that down so that you can call us up a little bit later. Our webpage is aboutpolygamy.com. You can go on the webpage and find information about polygamy, find resources and articles about polygamy, and there's also a link to our page for the streaming videos where you can go watch previous programs that you may have missed, or if you have friends or relatives who are outside of the viewing area of TV 20, they can go there and watch the previous shows as well. And we have an email address. It's tv@aboutpolygamy.com, and we invite you to send your emails to us with your questions or concerns, suggestions perhaps for a subject you'd like us to cover in future programs, and also that if you have anything that's confidential, we would be happy to respond to it there. And for our polygamous viewers tonight, we would like you to go to shieldandrefuge.org if you're having any questions or doubts about life in polygamy. And there you will also find articles and articles that compares the polygamy doctrine with the Bible. And there are stories there of people who have successfully fled from polygamy groups and have no regrets. And there's a contact page that you can contact if you have questions that you would like to be handled in a sensitive and a confidential way. Tonight, we are going to look at a very sensitive subject with the Mormon connection to polygamy. We're going to cover that in more depth tonight. Although our purpose for this program is not to intentionally offend anyone, we do know that truth, as Jesus said, will offend some. We have already been accused of inappropriately linking the fundamentalists with the present-day Mormon Church, and yet the link is there. And no one yet has accurately told us which information that we have been using is inaccurate. Some questions that I would like to ask you to think about when you deny that the polygamy connection is still there. The first question is, why do you continue to seal multiple wives to men in your temple ceremonies? The next question is, why do you still carry the commandment to live polygamy under your arm in your quad as you go back and forth to your church meetings? And why do you teach and preach from section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants and skillfully skip around the polygamy verses? Why is the command to live polygamy called everlasting? And can we truly set aside a doctrine that God has said is everlasting? Why do some of your missionaries tell people that polygamy will soon be restored to the church and then it will be required again? Either polygamy is an abomination, as your Book of Mormon says, or it's moral. It can't be both. God's definition of morality never changes. Joseph Smith had at least 34 wives. 11 of them were women who were married to already living husbands. Two of them were 14-year-old girls. Who is truthfully following the first prophet of the church? Brigham Young had 55 wives. Who is truthfully following the second prophet of your church? We suggest that you seriously think about these things. Our historical tidbit for this week is a quote that was made by Wilford Woodruff, and it's quoted in the Journal of Discourses, and this is what he said. If we were to do away with polygamy, it would only be one feather in the bird, one ordinance in the church and kingdom, do away with that, and then we must do away with prophets and apostles and revelation and the gifts and graces of the gospel. And finally, give up our religion altogether and turn sectarian and do as the world does, and then all would be right. We just can't do that, for God has commanded us to build up His kingdom and to bear our testimony to the nations of the earth, and we are going to do it. Come life or come death, He has told us to do thus, and we shall obey Him in days to come as we have in days past. Now, like I said, this was recorded in the Journal of Discourses, Volume 13. This was recorded on December 12, 1869, by Wilford Woodruff. The undisputed context of this quote is polygamy and the impossibility of doing away with it. 21 years later, the same Wilford Woodruff signed the manifesto which effectively banned polygamy from being practiced by Mormons. A true prophet of God can never be wrong. We invite you to seriously think on these things. I'd like to introduce our guest to you tonight so that we can get on with the subject of hand, which is polygamy. Our guest tonight is Sandra Tanner, whom I call the walking encyclopedia on early Mormonism and Mormon polygamy. And we're glad you're here, and we thank you for coming and giving us of your mind.
Right.
tonight, Sandra has agreed to discuss with us and with the viewing audience the subject of the Manifesto of 1890 and the Second Manifesto of 1904. So I'm sure we're all going to learn something new tonight. But before we get into the subject matter, I have a question that I really want to ask you. And it's one that I would just more or less like your opinion on. And it's not doing with the manifesto, but I've heard this and I just kind of like your opinion on it. I've read material from various sources that claim that polygamy was neither lived by nor preached by Joseph Smith at all. In fact, these people claim that the data that supports this position, that Smith didn't live it and didn't preach it, was that, and he actually fought against it. And so my question to you is, what is your opinion about this? And if there is a rebuttal due, and if it is, if so, what is it?
Well, that's the argument usually put forward by people in the reorganized LDS Church that followed Joseph Smith's son and never embraced polygamy. But the problem with that is, the whole early history of Mormonism shows there was polygamy behind the scenes since the early 30s. You have in 1831, Joseph Smith gives a revelation that some of his followers would go to Missouri to preach to the Indians, and he told them they were to take Indian wives to help raise a white and delightsome people. Well, these were men that already had living wives, so this would have meant polygamy for them. So 1831 is the first hint we have of polygamy. But then in 1835, you have the Mormons' new edition of their Doctrine and Covenants that has a section on marriage in it, section 101, that says they don't believe polygamy. Mm-hmm. Well, what church needs to put in a statement in their official canon that they don't believe polygamy unless there's problems that people think they are?
Behind the scenes
and,
going on.
And this is stuff going on with Joseph. And then you have the situation with Fanny Alger in Kirtland. And there's no doubt there was some sort of an affair there. The Mormons wanted to say she was one of his first plural wives, but Oliver Cowdery, one of the witnesses of the Book of Mormon, wrote to his brother Warren and said, "I stood Joseph to the face," and this is a quote, about his dirty, nasty, filthy affair with Fanny Alger.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, for the reorganized people to say there's no evidence that Joseph was involved in polygamy, it's there in the documents of the early history of the church. There are diaries in the 1840s that show Joseph's involvement in polygamy. William Clayton's diary shows day to day his discussions with Joseph Smith about polygamy, and Joseph telling him the problems he was having with Emma because of polygamy. Mm-hmm. The historical records are there, and even the reorganized church historians concede this now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just the lay people out there in the reorganized movement that haven't caught up with something that virtually all historians would concede today that Joseph's responsible for it. True, false, or indifferent.
That's true.
He's the beginning of the whole thing.
Isn't it funny how something like this that just hits you in the face that you know is a fact, and yet that people will continue to deny it?
Right. Well, and the other thing that Utah Mormons will say is that, well, he may have had marriages, but they were just on the books. They were for the hereafter. And they want to deny that he cohabitated with his wives. Mm. But in Andrew Jensen, who is a Mormon historian, in his volume Historical Record, written in, I think, in the 1880s, he went and collected statements from Joseph Smith's plural wives and from Joseph Smith's friends that all knew of polygamy and Nauvoo. And you have statements in there that the women were wives in very deed, in mm-hmm. actual fact. Mm-hmm. And one man tells of his sister marrying Joseph, and that they stayed the night in his home, mm-hmm. In the next bedroom. And so this man says, I know for a fact that they were married in actual fact, in every way that any marriage is in actual deed. You know, so I'm...
Plus, there's children from some
well,
of these women.
The Mormons
not a
would,
lot of documentation.
The Mormons would argue that there's no DNA evidence that there were children from Joseph Smith in these polygamous unions. But you do have Sylvia Sessions, one of Joseph's wives, who was married to someone else, on her deathbed telling her daughter Josephine that the reason she's mm-hmm. named Josephine
right.
is because she was Joseph's child. Now, the Mormons will say, well, there's no DNA evidence to prove that that's Joseph's child. Regardless of whether he was the actual father, obviously the question was in Sylvia's mind that it could have been. So he obviously was cohabitating with mm-hmm. Sylvia, who was a married woman.
Well, we could go on this DNA thing and, yeah. and kind of put it on another
so
level,
yeah.
but we won't. Okay. For possible viewers who aren't familiar mm-hmm. with what the manifesto is, would you explain to our viewers what the 1890 manifesto was?
Well, first off, we need to understand that polygamy was never legal.
Anywhere.
When in the United States. When Joseph Smith was living polygamy in Nauvoo, it was against the law in Illinois. Mm-hmm. So when the Mormons wanted to say they gave it up because it became illegal, it was always illegal.
Right.
But when they came out to Utah and admitted their plural marriage, this started repercussions from the government to try to stop it. And so you have them start enacting laws. And so there were a number of laws enacted along the way, first the Edmonds Act and then the Edmonds-Tucker Act, that declared polygamy to be illegal, but the Mormon Church wouldn't submit to it. They just kept going on. Well, the Edmonds Act, the first one, disenfranchised the church and started to have financial repercussions against the Mormons for it. Well, the Mormons kept living it, so the Edmonds-Tucker Act, then they came in and seized all the church property. Mm-hmm. So the church was in a great financial bind at this point. Is it going to bankrupt the church to go on mm-hmm. with this? Utah wanted to become a state. They couldn't become a state with polygamy. So there were all kind of pressures. So that's when, in 1890, you have the president of the church, Wilford Woodruff, give what is referred to as the manifesto. But it is a statement. It isn't a revelation. Mm-hmm. It's a statement where mm-hmm. he says that he's prayed about it and God's shown him it's time to quit practicing it for the time being because there's so much opposition to the whole thing. But behind the manifesto, you have to understand that John Taylor, who was the president just before Woodruff, had to go into hiding because of the Edmonds-Tucker Act. They were trying to arrest the Mormon leaders for practicing polygamy. All the church leaders had gone under the underground. Mm-hmm. And Taylor, in 1887, had given a revelation that they would never give up polygamy.
Right. Uh-huh.
And so then, just 3 years later, you've got Wilford Woodruff coming out with a thing, oh, yeah, we're going to give it up. But Taylor's dead at that point. But the manifesto was a bid to try to get them legitimized so they could get statehood
state.
To get their property back so the church could go on financially. Mm-hmm. But the curious thing is it doesn't incorporate a revelation. The Mormons want to say it was a revelation to stop polygamy, but it's a word of advice. It's a statement that, you know, it's my advice to everyone to stop the practice of polygamy. Mm-hmm. Now, the government understood that the manifesto, this agreement that the Mormons were going to give this up in order to get recognition and their property and all these kinds of things. included not cohabitating with their wives, not just
right.
not just not taking new ones,
right.
but they wouldn't cohabitate with them.
It was ended.
But the Mormons' leaders did not follow that. There was continuation of cohabitation with wives after that.
And there's a lot of proof of that, too.
Yeah.
And that was my next question. Did the church leadership and the mainline members stick with the, obey with the manifesto?
Well, the rank and file did, but not the leaders. And in fact, in this book, Solemn Covenant, by Carmen Hardy, he was a professor at University of Nevada, and in his book, Solemn Covenant, it's all about manifesto polygamy. And in the back of his book, he has a list of, I think it's 220
mm-hmm.
plural marriages that were entered into by church leaders.
By the leadership.
By the leadership, after the manifesto. So even though the rank and file might have generally stopped, the leadership were going behind the scenes and okaying more marriages. So there was great duplicity over this.
And they fled to Mexico and to Canada and,
right.
and to keep up with the living the polygamy because they continued to want to even though in Mexico, what was it, in 1844, they passed a law against polygamy too down there.
Right.
They just didn't enforce it, you know,
right.
like the
Well, the Mormons polygamous group was just over the border a long ways from the capital of Mexico, and so they were just kind of left alone. It was tolerated. Well, kind of the same thing you've got in Canada where it was just tolerated and ignored, and now it's grown to be a problem.
So what is the second manifesto of 1904? What is that, and what's different with that, and what did it accomplish?
Well, because the church leaders privately continued to practice polygamy, to seal new people in polygamy, to take more plural wives themselves, these different things started to leak out. And the government became more and more aware that there was some sort of underground polygamy still going on. Well, then you had a Mormon apostle, Reed Smoot, ran for the Senate and got elected. But when he went back to Washington, there was this big brouhaha about whether he would be seated, because all the non-Mormons didn't want to seat him, feeling that the Mormons were in defiance of the government. They were mm-hmm. still living polygamy. Now, Reed Smoot was not a polygamist, but he was an apostle in a church that was continuing
right.
to practice polygamy behind the scenes. So they had a big Senate hearing over whether Reed Smoot would be seated. So in order to try to gain favor in the United States, Joseph F. Smith got up in conference and gave this statement that is referred to as the Second Manifesto. It wasn't called that at the time, but he made a declaration at conference in 1904 that we really, really mean it. You got to quit living polygamy, and we're going to excommunicate people that go into it. But they still didn't start really enforcing it for several more years until more and more polygamists became outed, and they realized they had to start excommunicating
to start
people for
that.
It.
And I'd like to remind you that this is a live call-in program, and if you want to write the phone number down, it's 973-8820. We will be taking phone calls in just a few minutes, and you can make your phone calls and ask questions to either myself or to Sandra. The next question I have is, how did the LDS Church police its members to, or did they, did they do any policing at all, or did they just kind of let it go and trust them to do what was right?
Well, at first, there didn't seem to be any policing, and it was more a matter of kind of like the military, don't ask, don't tell, of, you know, just keep it to yourself and keep it low key so it doesn't become in the public press and aware to people. So there were a few excommunications along the line, but it was random. It wasn't systematic, and it had a lot to do with just personalities. But the church leaders themselves were continuing to marry people in mm-hmm. polygamy after the manifesto.
Mm-hmm.
And this creates the whole problem for later on for the fundamentalist movement that got going, was because of the duplicity of the church leaders on continuing to seal their own friends mm-hmm. in more polygamous marriages.
I've heard from different sources that the official but secret policy of the church was to let the polygamist continue at the time of the manifesto, continue to live with their wives mm-hmm. that they had at the time of the manifesto, and that the last one died in about 1945. And I've also heard that the last one died in about 1970s sometime or other. Do you know if that's the truth?
Well, the 45 date, I think, comes from the president of the church, who was a Heber Grant. So there's seven presidents of the Mormon church that all were polygamists. And the last one, I believe, is Heber Grant, who had three plural wives, and he died in 45. But during the time he was president of the church, he was not living polygamy. I think a couple of his wives had died, so he only had one wife at the time. Mm-hmm. He was president of the church, but he was a man who had lived polygamy.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, he's the last in 45 of the presidents of the church that was a polygamist.
But not actually living polygamy and cohabitating with the
not
other
at that
at the time.
But there were many people that entered polygamy through that 15-year period when the church was kind of allowing people to go into it, that of course would have kept living it for years afterwards, and their kids kept living it for mm-hmm. years after.
And they kept teaching it to their kids.
Well,
it was an ongoing doctrine. It's an eternal covenant.
And there's an assumption in the Mormons that all the polygamists are outside of Mormonism. I get calls from different people that tell me of polygamy going on in their wards that they know of. I mean, it isn't dead. It is out there in the Mormon church in a subculture that mm-hmm. tries to stay out of the limelight, they don't want the church leaders to know they're living
right.
polygamy because they'll get excommunicated. But it's never stopped.
Right. And I've heard that there's about 2-3% of mainline Mormons that actually live polygamy, and how they would know whether that's an accurate amount or figure or not, I really don't know.
I don't know, but I have reports. I mean, it's anecdotal. I can't prove it, but I talk to people who inform me of polygamists they've known or people that were living polygamy as an active member of the church in mm-hmm. some community or other.
I wonder why they don't leave and join one of the groups. Too much restrictions?
Well, then they can't go to the temple, for one thing.
Well, that's
if they
true.
Want temple access, they've got to stay within the folds of the regular Mormons.
Well, and there was a fear. In fact, I think there's still a fear among the Mormon leadership that people will leave or claim they're leaving a polygamy group and want to join the Mormon church so they can get their baptisms and so on, and then they'll, after they get all of this done with their family
right.
and get sealings done, then they'll go back to the church, or
right.
to the polygamy group, and the church won't fall for that.
And it makes a problem for people that leave the polygamous group that want to go back to the regular Mormons because
mm-hmm.
they're always suspect.
Mm-hmm.
The church is worried that it's someone trying to sneak back in and get approval and then go into polygamy on the underground or
mm-hmm.
something. So, yeah, they've got their problems trying to weed it out.
Yeah, I know a lady right now who she actually tried to leave, and the Mormons wouldn't help her. They said that they're a family organization, and we will not help you leave your husband, they said. We have a call coming in right now, Mary from Copperton. Hello, Mary.
Yes.
Yes, welcome to our program.
Oh, listen, I've got to talk to Sandra.
Okay.
Sandra?
Yes.
This is Mary Holiday.
Uh-huh.
Do you know George Flora?
Sure.
Okay. You know Heber City?
Yes.
Okay. And you're the lady that wrote The Base of Mormonism.
I didn't catch that one.
Pardon?
I didn't understand your last sentence.
You wrote The Maze of Mormonism.
No, I didn't write The Maze of Mormonism.
Well, anyway.
I wrote a lot of other books, but not that one.
Okay. Now, did you know that there is two books in the library in Heber City that's called Joseph Smith 1 and Joseph Smith 2? And I don't know who wrote them, but I tried to get them, but they're sealed for me. But, I mean, I thought that was real interesting, and I'm 80 years old, and George is in heaven with Jesus.
Yes. Right.
And I've been trying to get a hold of you for 20 years.
Well, I'm in the phone book. Give me a call sometime.
Okay, now what did you say?
I'm in the phone book. Sandra Tanner. Just look me up in the white pages, and you can give me a call at my bookstore.
Okay, fine. Thank you very
much. All
right. Much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Hey, we have Jerry from West Jordan. Hello, Jerry.
Hi.
Hello, welcome to our program.
Thank you. I just want to say, first of all, I'm nervous as heck. So I remember when Sandra and her husband, Gerald, left the church. And I was told to not even think of them, you know, to just totally just them in so many words, because I was brought up born and raised in the church, and I just want to say that I'm sorry that I ever did that, because now I think you are the bomb.
Good.
Not to diss them or anything, I love them dearly. My question is, I have so many questions, but what just came across my mind so quickly was that even if it was a revelation from God, you know, there's speculation on, you know, they were being forced, they couldn't be a state if they practiced polygamy, but even if it was a revelation from God, why did they not heed that revelation and just instantly stop if God said, you know, if God said don't practice polygamy anymore, why didn't they stop?
Well, I think the reason they didn't stop is because most Mormons realized it was a ruse to get the government off their back, and that they had their fingers crossed behind their back as a king's ex, that it didn't really count. That's why they had to have the Second Manifesto in 1904, was because everyone assumed it was just a front and that it wasn't serious.
Okay, I sure appreciate your time.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Good night. Okay, our next question I have is, tell us about the Mormon historians Michael Quinn and B. Carmen Hardy. You've got his uh-huh. book right there. They did some research on the post-manifesto polygamous marriages, and this is where the detail would come in on the 220 authorities and so on.
Right, and in Quinn's article was in Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, and it's a very fine study. But in Carmen Hardy's book, he has a chart of post-manifesto plural marriages performed by apostles. And he has a list of 67 plural marriages from 1890 to 1909 that were performed by apostles.
Wow.
And then he's got post-manifesto plural marriages that were amongst the apostles and first presidency from 1890 to 1909, and that was 13 amongst that group. So it's obvious that the leadership was continuing this. And my own great-grandfather, Brigham Young Jr., took a plural wife after the manifesto, and it's listed in here. It was fully believed. I mean, in the sense that if polygamy were really true, then I think you should live it. I mean, whatever you think, you know, if you really believe it, you follow it. And so these men at this time, at the turn of the century, really believed it, felt they had to live it to have eternal life. But they were being dishonest with the outside world, and they were deceiving the government, mm-hmm. and they were lying to their own church people. It's the duplicity of the whole thing that creates the problem of the fundamentalists today.
Well, I think it creates a problem in being able to trust much of what the church says anyway in those times, because it was planned deceit.
Right.
It wasn't just something that they had to think of, oh dear, we got to think of this. Yeah. They planned on doing it this way.
Right.
And so the foundation was actually a deceitful foundation. There was 220 post-manifesto plural marriages by general authorities. And then another chart in that book showed that there were at least 262 total plural marriages that were performed after the manifesto.
Right. Yes, it's just a staggering amount. That's why you can't say it was an anomaly. It was just a few members that kept living it or something. The involvement of the leadership shows an intent to continue to live polygamy after the manifesto.
Mm-hmm. It does. It certainly does. We invite you to call into our phone lines. We have a line open, and we would like you to call and ask either myself or Sandra a question about polygamy, and the number is 801-973-TV20. That's 801-973-8820. As we continue on with discussing the manifesto and polygamy and how it actually led to the present day schisms and the offshoots from the Mormon Church to these polygamy groups that we have now. So give us a call and we'll be happy to answer your questions. I read a statistic that there were about 3,300 children born to Mormon men who married polygamously 1890 through 1904, and that the president of the church, Joseph F. Smith's wives, bore him 13 children after the manifesto.
Right, and he was asked about this in the Reed Smoot hearings, and he admitted that he had fathered children after the manifesto, and in fact, he paid a fine for this. So
the president of the church.
President of the church paid a fine for having polygamous children after the manifesto. The polygamist involvement kept going. There wasn't a time when there was a break and then suddenly you have the fundamentalists.
Right.
You have to see this as a continuing history of Mormons who are living polygamy through this whole time period. And the church is trying to stop it along the way. I mean, after the second manifesto, the church starts trying to get everybody to really, really, really stop it. And so they have to sacrifice two apostles, Matthias Cowley and John W. Taylor, because they felt we got to do something to prove good faith with the government, that we're really excommunicating people. So the two most prominent apostles in post-manifestal polygamy were these two men. And so they first resigned from being apostles, not thinking it was going to cost them their membership, that they would just step down temporarily until things smoothed over, and then they'd be put back in. Yeah. And then the church realized, no, it had to really end. And so finally they excommunicated them. But there was always polygamists. There wasn't a break somewhere. There always were polygamists. And so the people that become the founders of these groups that evolve into these churches we see today that practice polygamy had their origin back in these early Mormons that continued to live polygamy after the manifesto.
Because they believe it's a command.
Because
from
they believe it's a command. And this revelation that John Taylor gave in 1887, there were people that were in the room when this was given who felt, right or wrong, they felt they had been set aside and ordained to carry on polygamy. So the most of the polygamists will tie in to those seven men or whatever it was that were supposed to be in the room, and Taylor gave this revelation that they had a special dispensation to carry on polygamy. So polygamy kept going all through the years. Now the church stepped up the pressure in the 20s and the 30s to excommunicate members when they found they were living polygamy. And then in the 1940s, there was a raid in Salt Lake. I mean, most people have heard about the Short Creek raid in the 50s, but there was one in the 40s here in Salt Lake where a bunch of polygamists were rounded up, and the church had kind of worked behind the scenes with the government to do a raid then, because they knew they had this problem. They had to stamp it out of the church. And so they're trying and trying and trying. And then finally in the 50s, you get the Short Creek raid. And so then you have the start of these different polygamous groups. Then they end up splintering on authority claims of who's the true prophet. And so if you followed it out on a chart, you would see this line of dividing off of different ones that got upset with the previous leaders, so they break off and start their own movement. And you end up with all these splinter groups, and today you have all kind of independent groups that don't even claim
they don't
to
have
tie
leadership.
In to one of these early groups. And that's a problem that polygamists face today, is there is this disintegration of leadership. So although there are many groups of them out there, they don't have strong leadership. As the generations have gone by, there's more and more confusion.
There is confusion, and new groups seem to be starting up too. We have several calls right now. We have Brian in Cottonwood Heights. Brian?
Yeah.
Welcome to the program.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good.
What can we help you with tonight?
I had a couple questions. I studied polygamy for a while, and one of the first women married by Joseph was a gal by the name of Zena Jacobs, and in her diary she talks of them coming to her home while her husband was away, and you know, and he was teaching her the spiritual library, and then she threw him out and he came back with Brigham Young, and by morning she relented, and she said in her diary that they took me into the field and Joseph married me for eternity and Brigham married me for time. I was wondering if splitting the marriages in polygamy was common, number one, because that's the only one I really came across. And, you know, later she was crossing winter quarters, and Brigham rode up on his horse and told Jacob, you know, was given to Joseph for eternity, me for time, she's come with me now. And she said, I went to his wagon, and I was just curious, you know, she became one of the 13 queen bee wives and bore him, I think, 13 children. But my question is mainly did they split them in marriage, you know, like one for eternity, one for time?
Not usually. That was an unusual situation. Usually whoever Joseph married for eternity, he was marrying for time as well.
Well, that was just very rare.
I think that was a rare kind of situation.
Yeah, I couldn't find it anywhere else. Another question came up. Did Joseph and Brigham have a deal that if one died, the other got the other one's wife?
I don't know what they discussed in that regard. I don't know.
Okay, you don't know that one.
I don't know if there was a deal, but it did happen a lot. Brigham Young did marry a lot of Joseph's widows.
Okay, that's what I was wondering if they ended up with them. Another question came up when I was doing my research was, did Joseph believe himself to be a direct blood descendant of Jesus Christ?
Well, there's evidence in different writings that the early church leaders thought that they were descended from Christ. There's some references that would imply that. I don't know how strong a case you could make for that, but there are indications of that.
All right, well, that was all the questions I had, and thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Brian.
All right, bye-bye. Mm-hmm.
Good night. Okay, we have Diana from Sandy. Hello, Diana.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
We're doing good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I have a question for both you and Sandra, or either or.
Okay.
I wonder what would be your opinion or suggestion on how the state should help women, in particular, get out of polygamy. And basically, I think a big question would be financially, how would they take care of their children?
I'll leave that to you. You probably don't know more.
Well, I wouldn't recommend the state help women get out of polygamy. There are individual and organizations who have been set up to do that. And in fact, the organization Children Refuge Ministry does do that exact thing. And there are ways that women can get the help they need. There are a lot of government agencies that can help, at least in the initial part of getting funding for food and so on. But there are people also who are willing and want to help these women, and we will help them. We'll do anything we can to help anybody who wants to leave an abusive situation in polygamy group.
Okay. And then another question, if I may, or a comment, is it's a surprise to me that the LDS church, the mainstream LDS church, does not help these people in that they sired this experience for people.
Well, I think the reason they don't want to help them is because they don't want any kind of connection that they're a part of it. They're trying to break everyone's connection with saying polygamy and Mormons are the same thing, and so if they were to help the polygamist, it would reinforce in the public's mind that there's a connection between the two. So the Mormon Church says that they shouldn't be called Mormon fundamentalists, they're their own deal and they're not part of us. So they're trying to avoid this association of them with the polygamist, so there's no way they're going to step in and help them and have that image portrayed that there is a connection between the two.
Or was.
Yeah, or was.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you, Diana.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. We have Mike from Ogden. Hello, Mike.
I just got a quick question for you. It concerns, I'm Catholic, this is the first time I've seen your show, but I'm familiar with Miss Tanner, Mrs. Tanner, mm-hmm. I'm not sure which it is. Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with her, through another MRM, I think it is, that website. And I just wanted to ask you, when it comes to salvation, I know, of course, it's grace by faith. That's but we Catholics, we believe that's the first step. It's grace by faith, and then that will make us want to do good works. Not saying that they're necessary. So I just wanted to throw that out there. And then, you know, I'm sure you've read C.S. Lewis.
Yes.
C.S. Lewis.
Right.
He said that, I was just reading Mere Christianity, and he was not by any means Catholic, but he says, he's talking about this grace, just pure grace, and just believing basically John 3:16. and that's not enough. He says, I mentioned, he says one thing about our being let off because Christ has volunteered to bear punishment instead of us. Now, on the face of that, it is a very silly theory. If God was prepared to let us off, why on earth did he not do so? And what possible point would there be in punishing an innocent person instead? So that's kind of where I'm coming from.
I think, well,
he's saying, you know, if it was just simply by believing with faith, then, I mean, I just don't think that's enough. You can't just believe and then go through. What do you guys believe?
Well, I believe that we are saved by grace.
I'm going to get off the phone and listen, okay?
Okay, right. Thank you, Mike.
Okay.
We are saved by grace, but when you enter into faith with Christ, you are entering into a love relationship with God. And if you have truly come into that love relationship, you're going to want to serve God. It's like saying when you get married, you're married. But of course, if you love your wife, you're going to do those things to please her and make for a better relationship. So Christians believe in serving God, in living righteous lives, and doing good works, but that doesn't make them more saved, just as taking out the garbage for your wife doesn't make you more married, but it certainly makes for a better relationship. And so a Christian sees a call to holiness, but not as it being a part of their salvation. Salvation's been completed in the work of Christ, but then we enter into a love relationship with God where we want to do those things that would please him.
And I would like to add, too, that if we could do anything that would add to the salvation that Jesus Christ paid for on the cross, then he died in vain. Was God stupid that he would put Jesus on the cross for our sins, and Jesus himself agreed to do this, and then in turn have our salvation be acquired some other way? I don't think so. He said, "It is finished." And "it is finished" means, in the original language, it means that it's paid in full, and that's our sin debt. It's completely paid in full at the cross, and when we embrace that by faith, God gives us the gift of salvation, and the Bible tells us that it is definitely a gift. Okay, on the telephone now we have Ralph in Salt Lake City. Hello, Ralph.
Hello.
Hello, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I'm a first-time caller. I've never called in before.
Well, welcome to the show.
My question is concerning child marriages. How prevalent was this back in the early days of marrying people to really young girls?
Well, you had Joseph Smith marrying a number of teenage girls, but he married a lot of women in their 20s and 30s as well, so it wasn't just teenage girls, but it was included.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when they come out to Utah, the problem you have is that there never were more women than men in the Utah Territory. Census records show there was always more men than women, which is true of any pioneer community. So that women would have been a premium. When you have women at a premium, then you're going to, where there's a limited number, you're going to find the marriage age going down because you've got to find more and more women, thus you have to start marrying younger and younger in order to get that number fulfilled for all those that want more wives. So it became an outgrowth of the system.
My great-great-grandfather was sealed to one of Joseph Smith's widows, and when he was sealed to her, she wasn't quite 14. Which meant that she had to have been about 12 if she died, if she married Joseph on the day he died.
Mm. No.
You know, I've seen some statistics on the normal age of marriage for women during that period of time, and the normal age was above 20 years old.
Yeah.
For the rest of society. A lot of the people will say, well, girls were married younger in those days, but that isn't the case according to the statistics.
Well, thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Thank you much, Ralph. Uh-huh. Bye. We have Kim in Salt Lake City. Hello, Kim.
Hi.
Hello.
I just had a question for Sandra, if I could.
Uh-huh.
I'm just wondering, what does it mean to have the restoration of temple blessings?
Oh, well, if you were married in the temple and then you got excommunicated for adultery or doing drugs or whatever reason, that you got excommunicated from the church, then you could come back into the church and after a year of showing you had repented or whatever, and then you may have to have a restoration of blessings if the sealings had been canceled. Like John D. Lee, that was executed for the Mountain Meadow Massacre, when he was excommunicated from the Mormon Church, they took away all his plural wives. But then years later, in fact, about 100 years later, the Mormon Church restored his temple blessings and gave him back all his plural wives on paper. I mean, you know, that's what they believed was happening. So it's restoring temple blessings is when someone has lost them through excommunication or something, and then at a later time the church restores them.
Okay, and so is temple sealings and temple ordinance, is that the same thing?
Yes. Well, you can go through some temple ordinances without having sealings.
Oh, okay.
But when you get married, that's a sealing. And if you get a divorce, there may be a situation where you would be a cancellation of your sealing. But sealing is referring to a marriage, whether you're going into the marriage or coming out of the marriage or whatever. Sealings or cancellation of sealing all has to do with the marriage for eternity.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kim, for calling. I'd like to remind you that we do have telephone lines open. You can call 973-8820 to get your questions answered. We do have a call right now from Stephen in Springville. Hello, Stephen.
Yes.
Thank you for calling.
Yes. I was wondering, was polygamy back in the day, was it a revelation or a commandment? And if so, what's the difference?
Well, I don't know that there is any difference between a revelation and a commandment. So, you know, I see it all being this. In Mormon thought, I would see them in the same thing.
Okay, well then, if it was a commandment at the time, how come the mainstream Mormons are so afraid of their past? So I don't get that.
Well, it's a public relations issue. They had Mormons want to appear normal, as American as apple pie, and the reminder all the time of their polygamous heritage becomes an embarrassment to that public image they're trying to portray, especially when you have all these polygamists in the news running around in these old-fashioned dresses and all, and the Mormons are trying to sell everyone that they're the ultimate American family, so it's a real problem for them to try to shed this image of polygamy.
Oh, I see. Okay, so it's kind of, they're just a little bit ashamed of their past.
Seem that. And I mean, I came from a polygamist ancestry, and it seems like a lot of Mormons talk about polygamy as though they'll talk about the fundamentalists today as being such a horrible practice, and yet, I don't know, half of us here in Utah have to be descended from polygamists. And I'm surprised that the Mormons aren't more proud of their ancestry and their own history, but they seem to avoid it.
Well, all right. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Stephen.
All right.
Good night. Okay, you can call us at 973-8820 for your questions to Sandra or myself. Sandra, what would Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, Heber Kimball, John Taylor, and the others say about the manifesto and the way the Mormon Church is treating polygamists today?
Well, I think they would be amazed to see how the church has walked away from its heritage. These men taught this as an essential part of their eternal family situation. This wasn't just an option. This was necessary. For Brigham Young, for the early church leaders, they taught that this was absolutely essential to have eternal exaltation. And I'm sure they'd be amazed to see the church today how they have distanced themselves from it. One of their own historians a few years ago did a biography of Brigham Young, if you can imagine, and never once mentioned polygamy in the whole biography. How could you do a biography of Brigham Young and not mention polygamy?
Yeah,
you know?
55
wives. So it shows
lives.
The embarrassment they have about their past.
And they do, and you know, the polygamy groups of today, of course, I was in a polygamy group and raised in one, and the mind control, the what they put in your mind from the cradle is that this is an unswerving commandment from God, and you don't get to heaven unless you live it. That's the way the polygamists were in the early Mormon days, so it truly is original Mormonism. What about the splinter groups? Let's talk a little bit about that, because that's what present-day polygamy is. How did they come about as a result of the hard line that the church began to take, finally, on the manifesto?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, you have these different Mormons that are living polygamy forming into groups. And the Short Creek group started with, the city was first started by a non-polygamist, but a Mormon guy. But then different polygamists saw the advantage of being on the border, mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. this would be a good place if you're hiding from the law to be right on the border. You can go to one state or the other mm-hmm. and avoid the law. So the polygamists started to moving, those that wanted to keep living polygamy, started gathering there, and then this formed in to the Short Creek group, but then that group splintered, and then you get the All Red group up here in Salt Lake, and you can start getting these different
and the
groups.
Kingston group also came
Kingston
from that
groups.
Splinter.
Now, the Kingston group today is a little different from the other groups because you can't, it's my understanding, you can't just join them.
No.
This is a family hierarchical deal. They're worth millions of dollars, and they keep it within the family. Mm-hmm. The Kingston group is different than how the other polygamists are.
But they
are.
Did start out from the original
from these other
FLDS
early
group.
Groups that were Mormons. Now, the LDS Church wants to say, people living polygamy today aren't members of the church, and most of them never have been. But what they don't explain is, yes, but their parents were Mormons or their grandparents were Mormon. Mm-hmm. These were people that lived polygamy, were excommunicated for it, and then their children continued to live polygamy. Mm-hmm. And it ends up with all these polygamous groups. But you keep getting these leadership divisions mm-hmm. and the breakoff groups. And so like the LeBaron brothers that were down in Mexico, you had, three or four different brothers that all claimed priesthood authority to continue polygamy, but then the brothers start dividing off from each other, and each of them ends up with their own following. So you have this disintegration. Mm-hmm. The Ruling All Red group, they lose their leader, and then his brother takes over, but then he's not as strong a leader, and so you end up with these problems. And so you get these splinter groups, independent groups. Most of them, I don't know about the independents, but most of the groups try to tie back to people that were set apart to practice polygamy from this revelation of John Taylor's.
Right.
The polygamists, those that tried to stay in within the church, more and more became convinced the church was going into apostasy for giving up polygamy.
Right.
But for many of the polygamists, the final blow was in 78 when the Mormons gave priesthood to blacks. Most of the polygamists all share in common certain basic beliefs, and one is that you have to practice polygamy for exaltation.
Right.
But the other is that blacks don't get the priesthood till the millennium. So in 78, when the Mormon Church gave priesthood to blacks, many polygamists that were still within the Mormon Church felt at that time they had to leave because they were afraid they'd lose their priesthood if they stayed in the apostasy that the Mormon Church had gone into. Most of the polygamists also believe Adam God. There was a Brigham Young teaching. So there's certain things they all have in common. Mm-hmm. But as they've splintered through the years, they've developed their own odd little doctrines that are all a little different
from
each
other.
And
that's right, they do. Mm-hmm. We're getting close to the end of our time tonight, but we do have Fred from Salt Lake City. Hello, Fred.
Yes.
Fred? Yes. Welcome to the show.
Yes. I wanted to ask a question if there was any evidence that Joseph Smith was involved in polygamous relationships prior to the official date of his revelation.
Yeah. Well, yes, there is evidence that the polygamy revelation is dated 1843, and the revelation itself says that Emma is to accept all those that have already been given to Joseph. So obviously he already had plural wives before the revelation was written down. But you have the case of Oliver Cowdery accusing him of an affair with Fanny Alger back in 1835-36 time period. So there's evidence that he was involved with women prior to the giving of the revelation. In fact, he marries Louisa Beeman in 1841. He married Louisa Beeman in 1841, and then he had a number of plural wives before he dictates that revelation in 43.
Okay. He hung up on us. He wanted to hear you off the air, I guess. So we have Thelma calling from Layton. Hello, Thelma.
Yes.
Yes. Welcome to the show.
Yes.
What is your question? Hello?
Yes?
You're on the air?
I was wondering about, in Revelation, it says about being sealed to God instead. Is that where they got being sealed to each other, women, and I mean the women to the men? And about the seven brothers that married the first, I mean the woman married the first brother on down the line. Now, who would she be sealed to? What would they say about that?
Well, the polygamists try to use those verses, but there's nothing in the Bible that says that those were temple marriages for time and all eternity. And Jesus specifically said that they erred because there was no marriage in heaven. And so there was no indication that that was any kind of teaching on plural marriage. We're sealed to God when we become a follower of Christ, but that sealing has nothing to do with any marriage relationship. It has to do with our commitment to God to accept His payment for our salvation. Then we're sealed to God, not to a husband. How would you deal with that?
That's a good answer, because we are not sealed to any. We're sealed by the Holy Spirit the moment we receive Christ as our Savior, and that is the sealing of the Bible. There's no sealing to family members or to spouses. Thank you, Thelma.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Well, we're getting to close to the end of the show again tonight. I'd like to thank Sandra for coming. There's still a couple of callers that we won't be able to answer, Mike and Jason. You can email us your question. We'd be happy to answer, or else call again next week. And I thank you for sharing all your great knowledge with us. It's been wonderful to have you here. I'd like to announce our guest for next week will be Susan Ray Schmidt. She'd been scheduled to be here on June 26th, but became ill and was unable to come. But she's better now, and so she'll be here next week to share her story. I'd like to quickly say a few closing words to our polygamous viewers who claim that God's laws takes precedence over obeying the laws of the land. And you'll often use biblical characters like Daniel, who continued to pray even though a decree had been given, and like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who refused to bow down to the idol even though they were thrown in the fiery furnace because of it. And in the book of Acts, where the disciples were thrown into prison because they continued to preach in Jesus' name, although they had been ordered not to. And these three examples that you are using are not pointing to what you think it is. They're pointing to your relationship with God. They're not talking about human relationships, and they're not talking about marriage relationships. The Bible commands us to pray, and so Daniel prayed. And the Bible commands us not to fall down before an idol. It forbids us against that. And so that's what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego obeyed. And the Bible commands us to tell others about Jesus. And that's what the people in the temple were doing. They were obeying. But the Bible never commands us to live polygamy. And so therefore, your reason is not valid. And you really should obey the laws of the land and your Mormon books and our scriptures that command us not to live polygamy, but to love God. We'd like you to think on these things. Thank you for joining us, and see you next week on Polygamy, What Love Is This?
This has been the audio podcast edition of Polygamy, What Love Is This? This program is a production of A Shield and Refuge Ministry and Main Street Church of Brigham City. You can view current and past video episodes as well as download audio episodes of this program at whatloveisthis.tv. If you or someone you know is in need of assistance in leaving a polygamous situation, please contact us. We are here to help. All of our contact information can be found at shieldandrefuge.org or call us at 877-425-9993. If you have any questions or comments about this or any of our other programs, we'd love to hear from you. Write us at email at whatloveisthis.tv. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us again.